Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Harriet Russell. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Phil Oakley, how are you, Phil?
I'm all right, thanks.
Excellent. So we're going to talk, Phil, about some of the stuff that you've mentioned in your Alpha report, which I think we're going to send out tomorrow, Friday, that is, which also coincides, interestingly, with some of the results that we've covered in the magazine this week. And Harriet, it's another retail week.
It's another retail week, but also a healthcare week.
And a healthcare week. Big mover on the markets this week. The biggest mover on the markets this week.
Absolutely.
BTG. But also, it's Black Friday.
It's Black Friday.
Which I think we briefly mentioned last week. It's upon us.
It is upon us. And, you know, traditionally, you know, predecessors of mine, including yourself, would have been very preoccupied with the Christmas trading period. And that has been completely changed by the arrival of Black Friday.
Black Friday didn't exist when I covered retail.
No.
No. Let's start with Black Friday.
Okay.
What the hell is this? Is this another awful US import?
Absolutely is, yeah.
Phil is nodding vociferously there. Is it... I mean, I guess the big question about Black Friday is why are retailers doing it? Is it helpful for them or damaging for them? And I guess the answer is, depends on who you are.
Depends on who you are, but actually, I would argue these days... they do it because they have to not almost looks a bit churlish. Although we can get onto that in a sec. There is a backlash, in my opinion.
Having said that, I must point out that we have a Black Friday subscription.
So we're just as bad.
20% off subs all weekend.
There you go. Well, that's one of the better deals out there.
Nothing to do with me. But yes, anyway, tell us about Black Friday and what it really means for the UK retail sector.
Yeah, obviously it is an American import. Thanksgiving is today, Thursday, in the US. Shout out to all my US family while I'm here. But yeah, it was originally designed because the US take Thanksgiving almost more seriously than they take Christmas. And for that reason, you get an extra day off work. Woohoo, Friday.
Do they get Christmas off as well?
They do, but it's a lot more punitive. They don't have a Boxing Day, really. So right. They literally get Christmas Day. And then some people have to go back to work the next day. And same thing with... I think they get New Year's Day off as well. But my sister, who does work in New York, you know, she gets 10 days holiday a year. And she's at a pretty senior level in a PR firm. So it's really quite a harsh system that they have out there. So because of that, you know, the extra day after Thanksgiving was a big deal because it basically gave you a four-day weekend. You have Thursday off as well, obviously. And on that Friday, people seemed to think that there was nothing better to do than get a crack on the Christmas shopping. So they would head out to the shops, and it didn't take long for a lot of retailers to realise the value that this day had to the shopping calendar. So much so that it soon became the first day in the entire annual calendar that retailers would, quote, tip into the black and turn profitable, hence the name.
And this does tie into what we know about UK retailers, that actually most of their profits are delivered over the Christmas period.
Absolutely. It's peak. It always has been. But the timing of quite when that started, I would say, in this country was actually pretty late. It wasn't definitely until the start of December, but even as close as up to 2 weeks before the big event. Now it starts earlier and earlier and earlier because one of the biggest reasons that the entire Black Friday phenomenon got imported in the first place is because of Amazon. It obviously was a US company partaking in this and realised its potential overseas if it just started offering the same things to its international customers, which it soon did. Lo and behold, Amazon sets the bar for most of what goes on in retail, and so other retailers in this country have little option but to follow suit.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, Amazon obviously has been, as we have discussed many times in this podcast, a very, very challenging competitor for many UK retailers to deal with. I'm sure it will do wonderfully out of Black Friday. What about everyone else?
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, is, of course, Amazon has arguably the logistics capability to cope with this sort of demand. And there is a demand, I have to say. I mean, that's the first caveat to put out there. People who sort of scorn Black Friday and call it some sort of dreadful demonstration of materialism or whatever, sorry to tell you folks, but people buy into it in a big way, particularly in this kind of climate where, you know, budgets are under pressure and household incomes are under pressure. So that's the first thing to say. But you know, people like M&S particularly, and other high street retailers simply don't have the logistics infrastructure to cope with that demand.
Online,
absolutely. Because, of course, what happens here, and I've mentioned this in the Sector Focus this week, is that we don't get an extra day off work unless, like some people I do know, take it as holiday. So the phenomenon...
Sorry, people take Black Friday as holiday?
Yep.
To go shopping?
Yep. Yeah, sorry to break it to you, but that's how seriously some people take it. So for us, the phenomenon has become largely digital. You know, I've put some interesting stats in there about how online sales do on Black Friday traditionally compared to footfall on the high street. And it's a completely sort of converse state of affairs, unsurprisingly. So yeah, when we're talking about how retailers cope with the event, we are talking about how they cope with the online demand and fulfilling that demand.
I mean, this suggests to me it's kind of exacerbating the trend for the strong to get stronger.
It does, because ultimately what you're going back to is a discount war. And so not only are you on the one hand quite operationally having to cope with this huge demand, you're then in a strictly financial sense having to decide where you're going to take that pain. Are you going to promote extensively in order to keep up with the competition and therefore significantly damage your margin, or are you going to not discount quite as aggressively to limit damage on margin but then perhaps not make it up in the volume?
One of the things that intrigued me about all the Black Friday things is, does it actually increase the amount of sales that the retailers actually make, or is it just spreading the peak Christmas selling season over a longer period, so people will take advantage, if indeed they are taking advantage, of a perceived offer now, and they buy it now instead of what they would have bought 3 weeks later?
Absolutely. This is something I also address in the piece, which is what's now become known as drag forward, which you're absolutely right. This is one of the other major problems with it, is that rather than the sort of rather idealistic hope that by starting Christmas shopping early, you suddenly extend this sort of surge in volume for 8 weeks as opposed to four. All that happens is that purchasing decisions, A, get delayed in October. We saw that massively in the ONS stats that came out for last month. You see this huge spike over this week now, because it's become a week-long phenomenon, let me tell you. And then you see a massive drop-off between now and Christmas. And maybe the week before Christmas, you start to see a little bit more ramping up. But it's last minute.
You mean the people who've left buying their presents at the last minute?
Yeah, absolutely. It's last-minute purchasing decisions, most of which by that point aren't done at full price either. And if you've followed any of the big stocks this year in retail, you'll know that it's full price sales that ultimately are driving any kind of meaningful growth. So this whole stretch now for them is becoming really quite depressing, because they're just having to revert to what most of the strategy has been trying to avoid for the rest of the year.
It just seems like an act of self-harm to me.
It really is. It really is.
Yeah, and you know, this is why I brought up the point about the strong getting stronger, because you know, we obviously in the sector focus, which is what this is, always points at favourites and outsiders. And, you know, the favourites are guys that can actually manage the whole thing in a clever way. You know, the JD Sports, who people will buy full price from them anyway.
Exactly.
And, you know, they can just perhaps push some stuff that struggling to get rid of.
The favourites are people who can charge full price even on Black Friday itself and still be assured that someone will make a purchase somewhere. And that really comes down to a handful of very, very strong brands. And that is actually a key word, I think, over Black Friday, because you can sort of hope for volume anytime throughout the year. But if your customers aren't loyal to your brand, then the ability to charge them full price at any point throughout the year is a challenge. And that's what's been happening for some of the middle market mass retailers. But for people like Ted and historically Superdry, not this year.
JD Sports springs immediately to mind. You've mentioned it here, but yeah, there is Jules. Little price sensitivity on trainers, yeah. I promise you.
Absolutely. And similarly, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, the discounters will probably do well out of it as well, because they don't get a disruptive force from anything that really goes on the internet. So they can still hope to do well out of very price conscious consumers.
More pain for department stores. Debenhams, Debenhams is almost on perma sale.
Yeah.
It just must make it a little bit worse.
Yeah.
How the expert view, which is really interesting actually, gives some sort of granular data on what sectors, what categories we can expect to do well on Black Friday.
Yeah.
Also mentions the pure play online guys, Asos, Boohoo. How are they coping with it?
It's interesting because I would say as the years go on and the markets become more saturated in that sort of online fast fashion, pure play, whatever kind of, you know, descriptor you want to put on it, it's going to become harder and harder to pull out any kind of advantage, because not only are those guys having to invest hugely at the moment in warehousing and logistics to keep up with each other, but their offerings are becoming less and less differentiated. You know, there's now a whole host of people selling rather sort of cheap garments, and you know, the appeal to necessarily buy that stuff for 15 quid off, whereas it's not actually that expensive throughout the rest of the year. I don't know. Does it really get you excited?
It certainly doesn't get me excited. Phil?
Me neither.
But to point out the converse, you know, someone like Ted, who goes into 2 annual sales a year, that's it. They're suddenly offering you 20% off this weekend. Why not?
I'm there.
Well, your kids are.
I'm there too. I like Ted Baker.
There you go.
Am I right in thinking that a retailer like Next, which always prides itself on not discounting before Boxing Day, doesn't take part in this?
Well, I suspect it will take part in it. But of course, someone like Next, who sits there proudly on its soapbox now and says, we don't discount, rewind 18 months ago, they couldn't stop discounting. They couldn't get anyone to buy their product. It's really been the strategy this year that Lord Wilson's cracked down on promotions in exactly the same way that M&S has. It's the only thing that saved them this year. I made this point in a piece a couple of weeks ago as well. So, yeah, to return to that sort of discounting atmosphere, it is a danger sign for them. But if they can go the same way as someone like Ted or JD and make it feel like more of a one-off for their customers, then maybe those customers will feel inclined to take part.
So the question is, can Black Friday save Britain's retailers?
No.
I think the answer is a definitive no.
No.
It might be good for Royal Mail, obviously, because lots of stuff will be being shipped at this point.
Yeah.
We've covered the results of Royal Mail this week. I think we might have touched upon them last week on this podcast. I'm not sure. Getting confused between podcasts. Now, I did another podcast for someone else.
Potentially not, but those results were pretty shocking. So they're going to need Black Friday to boost that parcels business back up to where it was.
Yeah, it's a very competitive industry, though, as we're seeing, especially with Amazon. Obviously, taking a much greater control of its distribution than it had previously. On the opposite page of the results section, we have EasyJet, which I know you've covered this week in your Alpha newsletter. Now, I wrote some very disparaging things about the airline business a couple of weeks back. We've had some horrible results from the sector. Flybe obviously put itself up for sale. Dark Group's results, which are also in the magazine, which we definitely did speak about on the podcast, were pretty interesting. EasyJet, you're a little bit more convinced by this story.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting company for me, from my point of view at the moment. The sector is pretty much hated. I mean, EasyJet shares are down by best part of a quarter year to date. There are lots of issues going on in this market in terms of capacity. A lot of other airlines have had problems. EasyJet itself has taken on a loss-making operation out of Berlin, at Berlin Airport, which is diluting its results. But actually, I had a good pour over these figures, these full year figures yesterday, and I think there's grounds for optimism with EasyJet in terms of what it's doing with its costs and its revenue generation, particularly what they call ancillary revenues, so non aircraft ticket seat revenues. That might involve getting people to pay for better seats and things like that. But the big thing that really intrigues me is the this quite concerted push that they're going to try and make into the holiday market.
Yeah, this is interesting. I always thought they were quite active in holidays. I know it's been part of their website for a while, but your view is that it's kind of been half-hearted, and they're perhaps looking at competition who are, in fact, in some cases, buying their capacity and thinking, hang on a minute.
Yeah, I think by their own admission, this is something that they haven't exploited as much as they should have done. And they probably look at, you know, a company like On the Beach, which is extremely profitable, very low overheads, very little capital invested, making good money, essentially by booking seats on their airlines, on EasyJet Airlines and others, and booking hotel space. And EasyJet thinks, well, we're the people that actually ship the holidaymakers to their destination. We've got all the IT in place. We've got a lot of customer intelligence. Let's have a go at taking a bigger slice of this market. And I think there was something in the results saying that I think out of 20 million passengers that they carried, I think fewer than 500,000 booked a hotel with them. Now, I'm not sure what they're hoping to get that sort of percentage up to, but that is sort of them saying, look, this is a pretty low percentage. And the amount of incremental investment that EasyJet is going to have to put in to do this, because a lot of the investment's in place, you know, in terms of the selling model, the IT and so on. If they can make a success of this, it will take some time, but you're looking at a business that has a lot of fixed costs. If you can get this incremental revenue, a profitable revenue, then you have the potential to move the profits along quite nicely.
I mean, it is an interesting industry. I mean, travel was, I mean, go back to the dot-com boom. Travel was one of the areas that people did, you know, identify quite quickly as an area that could be significantly disrupted by the internet.
Yeah.
And you had the likes of Last Minute come along. Ebookers, I think, are they still going?
I'm not sure.
But nevertheless, you know, it hasn't really happened at the pace that you would have expected it to.
I think that's in terms of the booking process. You know, it's the barriers to entry in sort of classic travel agency business have come down. The internet has brought that down. You don't need lots of high street shops and lots of people. You need good, well-invested, efficient IT, and then somebody to build the relationships with the airlines and the hotels, and you're away. Clearly, you know, it's a question of who holds all the cards in this. Is it the middleman, the travel agent, or is it the owners of the assets that actually make up people's holidays, the planes and the hotels? And I would be inclined to believe that it's the latter. And this is where I think EasyJet is trying to sort of cut out the middleman, and which is a trend in itself across many aspects of our economy, cutting out the middleman, getting customers to go direct, offering them a better price, and you pocketing an extra bit of profit margin on the side. And I think this is what it's all about. I think this is a. I'm not saying this is something that would solely make me very positive on EasyJet. I think it is one of many positive themes I can think developing in this for this business. I mean, there's other things.
One of which is capacity reduction, obviously, as other rivals go bust.
Yeah, I mean, but they're putting a lot of capacity in. You know, they've put in 10% capacity for the year just finished, and they're going to put another 10% capacity in next year.
And I think this is one of the worries about Dart, who, as I mentioned, we have results in the mag this week, that they've put in a lot of capacity too.
Yeah.
Yeah, EasyJet actually looks quite disciplined against some of those smaller operators. But arguably, those smaller operators are desperate, right? They're trying to sell many more routes, many more sort of obscure destinations, but that's not always, you know, onto a winner when your load factor isn't keeping pace.
Yeah, and your yield. You know, your passenger yield, the revenue per seat, that is key. You know, when you've got a lot of fixed costs, you've got a fuel price that goes all over the place, it's hard to get the economics of flying planes right all the time. And, it's a very volatile industry. But I think EasyJet doing some good things. They've the fleet as well, they are moving to more efficient planes. They're ordering Airbus A321s, which are cheaper per seat than their sort of core A319. Now, that's going to take some time, but that can bring the cost per seat down as well. And if they're working on this revenue, ancillary revenue as well, and they're being disciplined with their capacity and also targeting that capacity on the right routes, then, you know, you're looking at a share that's on 9 times next year's earnings, yielding 5.5 on dividends that are covered twice. And I just think, given where it's come from, these are not buy and hold stocks for sure. But, you know, maybe this is something that's fallen quite a long way and is starting to get interesting again.
Yeah, No, absolutely.
I mean, I've bought it, I've sold it, I've bought it, I've sold it. That's EasyJet for you, I think.
I've travelled it, and I have to say I prefer to travel it than some other airlines who we shall not mention right here, and who I most certainly would not buy a package on and take off. But there you go. Let's stick with the travel theme. SSP. That's big news here. Kate Swan.
Yeah.
She's off.
Yeah. And people might wonder, if they're not familiar with that name, why SSP, which is not necessarily that well-known company in itself.
I bet most people have eaten something that they sell.
Yeah, they definitely will have. You know, Upper Crust and all of those big brands that you see around the station and airports, that's SSP. But yeah, Kate Swan was obviously chief executive at WH Smith for 10 years up until 2013. So she was credited when she was there for sort of really keeping the station afloat and sort of pushing it into travel, which it now is thriving at, arguably, even though High Street's, you know, it's a game of two halves. But obviously she's taken that travel now over to SSP and done a pretty decent job with it, I have to say, since flotation.
Yeah, I heard her described this week as like one of the few, you know, like genuine management geniuses that there are on the UK listed market.
Those are Shawcap's words. Not
was it Shawcap?
It was Shawcap.
I can't remember where I read it. Thank you, Harriet, for clarifying that. But no, I mean, she genuinely, I mean, WH Smith, I mean, it's kind of miraculous what was happening there, given the way that, you know, what she inherited and some of the trends that were afflicting that business.
Yeah, I think she's just really talented at fighting on two fronts, which is all of WH Smith's story, really, which is like, how can we claw costs out of the business on one side, and where are the areas for growth on the other? And she's really transformed, I think, that business into what it still is today, which is pushing into travel, taking advantage of a lot of the same themes which underpin the case for SSP growth as well. So her mark is still firmly on both companies, I would say.
I'm just looking at that share price. That's a Kate Swan drop, isn't it? Surely. You've written about SSP this week, haven't you, Bill?
It's a decent business. I actually prefer to have my money in WH Smith's travel business than SSP.
But you can't just buy WH Smith's travel business.
No, that's the problem.
No. But I wonder if something will eventually happen at WH Smith to it'll spin off or die off.
I wrote a feature about that. It must be 7 years ago. It's just they're gonna spin it out. It's gonna be spin
how
out.
Prophetic.
But I think
pathetic.
No, I did not.
I've looked at WH Smith a couple of times actually over the last 2 or 3 months, and I think the value of the retail business, the travel retail business, is probably reflected in WH Smith's share price. But I think I think if you look at its performance, I think WH Smith is a much more profitable travel business than SSP. Maybe because it's got more exposure to airports than rail. Rail is a bit softer for SSP than air. And of course, obviously, with Kate Swan going, the obvious question that's going to be asked is she getting out at the top?
You could have said that about WH Smith as well.
You could,
but the share price fall yesterday was pretty sharp for SSP. It's a pretty big company, so you don't often get huge sort of swings either way. But, you know, her departure, it was front page news at the FT as well. So
the other thing as well is this is a very highly rated share.
Mm.
And to keep the momentum going in a share like SSP, you need profit upgrades. And I think if you look at the outlook statement, there was certainly nothing to suggest there in terms of the direction of sales or profit margins that was going to lead analysts to move their numbers higher. So I think that also, I think, probably had some impact on the share price, even though Kate Swan's departure is the obvious conclusion to come to.
Yeah. Well, we're still saying buy in the magazine, but I think it's one that we probably are qualified by.
It's a quality stock and you're going to pay for it. You know, it's just one of those. From when we have covered it, it's been a fairly reliable performer. And I totally take Phil's point. But I would also say historically, it's not been a hugely over chatty kind of management team that's, you know, desperate to sort of get those upgrades going when it can and sort of fuel share price growth. It would prefer almost, I think, sometimes to sit on the numbers and then outperform at the time of release. So a slightly muted outlook, I wouldn't necessarily say that's a huge sign of nervousness on that part. I would just say maybe it's reflective of their usual conservative kind of approach.
It's a fairly quiet company.
Yeah.
You know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah. Sorry, Phil. Yeah. I think my only concern with this business, and to an extent, similar extent, the WH Smith business, is that you're dealing with concessions.
Mm.
Now, these concessions don't last forever.
Yeah, contracts.
And,
I mean,
and eventually, you know, you have to renew them. And, you know, you're looking at the characteristics of the business here, which look quite nice to a lot of people, probably want a slice of this. So I think one of the key risks of a business like this is that when you come to renew a concession, obviously if you're the incumbent, you're in a good position. The question is, do the economics of the renewal get worse?
I mean, essentially, because you're talking about outsourcing risk, aren't you?
Yeah.
In the same sort of bracket, because it's that same, you know, ultimately, will they just have to undercut their competitor?
Or will the sort of the concession, the company or the organisation that awards the concession say, you're making too much money out of this? A lot of these are on turnover-based rents. So look, we're gonna up the take.
Mm.
And that's something that, you know, you might want to consider if you're looking at these kind of companies.
Yeah, but you have good operators there. I mean, the replacement, Simon Smith, I think his name is, has been running the UK business, obviously a, you know, very important component of SSP as a whole. So
yeah.
So it's in safe hands.
Yeah, I mean, my experience with M&S teaches me that that's not always the safest kind of bet to make. But, you know, it's the only facts that we have to work with at this particular moment. And he's done incredibly well with that business. In those results, I think the UK and Ireland business was up 9% operating profit. So, yeah, all seems to be going well. And he seems to be qualified to do the job.
And he's got some good assets to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. He's inheriting a strong business, which is always an advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's head to healthcare.
Yes.
From food to healthcare. Late night fast food to healthcare. So two things you've written this week which caught my attention. Hutchison China Meditech in the tip updates page. I can't pronounce it. They've had a bit of a problem here.
Fruquintinib,
is that,
I think.
Okay.
That might be wrong too. Yeah, they've been, I mean, it's their major kind of drug, and it's a cancer drug, and it's already been approved for some patients with a very specific kind of cancer. And what they're essentially trying to do now in China is run additional clinical trials on it to extend its usage, which is not unusual. It's a very normal kind of trope in pharmaceuticals to do that. Unfortunately, this week, one of those trials for non-small cell lung cancer failed in phase three. It didn't reach what is called its sort of primary endpoint, which loosely translated means main purpose, which is that it didn't slow or make any sort of discernible effect on survival rates. It did, however, meet several of its secondary endpoints. So things like safety, does it control the disease rather than cure it, and things like this. And it did meet a host of those secondary endpoints. But the market takes any clinical drug failure at this stage very badly.
What was the response on the day?
It was bad. The shares were down, I think, it was a while ago now, but about 18%, something like that on the day. That was in early trading, I should say. I don't know what the close was off the top of my head. But yeah, I mean, it's not unusual. I mean, actually on the same day, Astra had a drug failure as well, and that wasn't taken well either. So it doesn't actually sort of matter what size your company is or sort of how prolific you are or what you're essentially trialing. If it's important to your company and it fails in phase three as opposed to preclinical or phase one.
Because you've pumped so much money into it to get to that point.
Absolutely. You've spent a lot of money in R&D, and now you've spent a lot of money probably even on pre-commercialization. If you're that sure it's going to work, you're probably ramping up a sales force, marketing materials. You're probably starting to circulate with the regulators and even physicians maybe. So, you know, to then see it all kind of collapse is frustrating. It's just a write-off basically.
Yeah, still positive on the company overall though?
Overall, yes, because that drug, as I say, that was an extension of its use. It wasn't its kind of like sole bread and butter, and it will still launch on the market. I think next year is mooted at the moment for its initial kind of cancer treatment. So it's not been and gone, but obviously what the market is reading into this is if it can't be extended into a sort of very similar kind of cancer, how many other cancers could it actually affect? Is it going to be a single use drug, which would obviously be very limiting in terms of revenues going forward?
No, interesting. Actually, there's a positive number on that page this week. Learning Technologies. That's really interesting.
Mm.
Another positive bit of news for shareholders, at least. BTG.
Yeah.
This is the lead news story.
This really took us by surprise. They only had results on something like the 8th of November. So we're talking, you know, by the time I was writing this, we were actually only talking about a week ago. And yeah, they've received a takeover offer from a US company called Boston Scientific, although the actual offer has come from a newly incorporated subsidiary, effectively, which they've set up.
Off on the way.
Yeah. But the main buyer is Boston Scientific, which is a big US company. And to say the offer is generous, I think, is fair, actually. There was a bit of dispute between the analysts.
I was going to say, not generous enough for Numis.
No, not at all. In fact, their sort of research on it was quite harshly worded, and they think that a bidding war will emerge as a result, although the board has already said it's going to unanimously recommend it, and that they've received irrevocable undertakings from approximately a third of the shareholding base. So if a bidding war did break out, we're going to have to talk about a minimum offer of 925, considering that the current offer is 840, and that's already a 51% premium to the 90-day moving average. I would say that any potential kind of rival bid is going to have to be seriously punching.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, bidding wars, sometimes good time to buy. I mean, you buy the, you know, by the possibility that someone's going to cough up a bit more, but we're saying hold here.
I mean, yeah, because I'm not actually sure that a bidding war could work out. I mean, if it works out, then obviously from a shareholder's point of view, that's great. You're earning more and more return. But I think in this case, if the bidding gets aggressive, then what could actually happen is that Boston Scientific walks away altogether.
It's interesting. You know, BCG. You know where BCG came from?
Yes, I do.
Probably because I've talked about it ad nauseum. It's the last remaining bit of the UK's industrial policy of the 1970s. It's the NRDC. In fact, it goes back earlier than that, but it's the NRDC, and it came through the National Enterprise Board, which was essentially the government's VC wing. Yeah, it didn't really work out in the main, but...
No, it's a funny old company. I mean, it's a big company, I should say, but what it has attracted criticism for in the past is it's not particularly cutting edge medicines.
I remember it from years ago. It was varicose veins.
Still is.
Is that its big thing?
Still is its main product, Varithena. Yeah, and they've had major problems with it because they failed to get the correct US code for its insurance reimbursement. So the initial sales of that were completely decimated. And it has now got what it calls interventional medicine, which includes some oncology drugs, which obviously is a buzzword still in the industry all these years later. And I think that actually this fed into Numis's kind of criticism of the offer was that it thinks that Boston has undervalued the potential of that interventional medicine sort of division. And others are saying, well, yeah, but interventional medicine, I mean, it's a drugs pipeline, so it's all theoretical anyway, as we've just discussed at Hutchison China, it could fail. And in the results that we covered 2 weeks ago, it wasn't interventional medicine that really pulled it out of the bag. It was the legacy pharma business that surprised everyone. So to say that it undervalues something that isn't real, I mean, welcome to pharmaceuticals, but I think it's probably not very fair. If I was a shareholder in BTG, which I'm not for clarification purposes, I would vote in favour of it. I would take it and run.
Yeah. Either way, it's nice to have a bit of good news in a market which has been pretty horrific. Have you been keeping tabs on the market this week, Phil? It's been a bit exciting.
I've sort of, you know, had my ear to the ground. Yeah.
No, we've written about obviously the big sell-off in tech this week. Mark Robinson has taken a look at that. We've actually talked to the secondary feature this week is about some real horror show companies over the years. It's our book club, which Tom Dines has written, looking at BHS. Harriet's wincing over there. Enron, everyone's wincing. Yeah, I mean, it's been an extraordinary week. And we haven't even talked about politics.
No, but they are in 7 days if people need any kind of reminder.
I like not talking about politics.
Yeah, well.
I mean, yeah, quality is something that I think people are gravitating towards in this market, as well as gold, which is the cover feature. Gold has had a good week, as everyone else has been having a bad few months. Quality, Phil, this is your big thing. This is the subject of your book, and it's the subject of your column this week.
Yeah.
And also a subject dear to all our hearts, alcohol.
Yeah, yeah. I like to talk about good quality businesses. It's the struggle is to get these at good prices, but had a good look under the bonnet at Diageo this week. And quite like what I see, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we briefly spoke about it last week because they sold a portfolio of lesser-known brands.
Yeah.
In fact, I looked at them. Goldschlager?
Sambuca? Yeah, they sold...
It's the kind of thing we used to drink after about 11 o'clock at night in, in the late 90s.
Yeah, they're getting rid of brands that they don't have a lot of faith in long term. It doesn't fit their strategy of taking their products up market. And this is obviously a big theme in consumer facing industries now, of premiumization. Getting people to pay higher prices for higher quality products or perceived higher quality products.
Well, it kind of ties in what you were saying about retailers who are going to do well from Black Friday. Mm-hmm. They are premium, or they are not necessarily like super premium, but companies that are able to command what they want to command for the things they sell.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the high street it's referred to something strange like upper echelon or upper aspirational lifestyle or something clunky and horrible and corporate like that. But you can kind of get the gist. It's price points that sit around the sort of Ted Baker mark. So we're talking like maybe 100 quid for a jumper. So it's not completely alienating in the sort of Burberry sense, but it's equally not going to be a 35 quid jumper from M&S.
Yeah, so low price sensitivity. And that seems to be where the Diageo is going.
In most of it, and certainly in developed markets, yeah.
Yeah.
In America, which obviously the biggest world market, biggest chunk of Diageo's profits, that's what they're trying to do. That's where they need to do a bit more work, actually. But underlying this is a business that's been on the up for the last 2 to 3 years now, and looks like there's more to go. I think this is a very interesting... Alcohol is actually a very interesting market because of the development of craft products. And obviously we've seen in the UK here the development of things like craft gins and also craft whiskies. And the concern would be that for a big, gigantic company like Diageo, is it nimble enough to actually innovate and exploit these trends? And I think... if you have a good look at what's going on in Diageo, I think it clearly is. Certainly with its gin brands, its Tanqueray gin brand, it's doing extremely well with that.
Tanqueray is an extraordinary product.
Tanqueray, and there's Tanqueray 10 as well. But also Johnnie Walker, in terms of premium blended scotches, they've got premium single malts.
I know you like a Johnnie Walker Black Label.
I do, actually.
Didn't you drop one at the airport on the way back from America?
I did, yeah. I dropped a litre bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label. I was devastated.
Jet lag, was it?
Yeah. But it's not just the spirit side. They have a phenomenally strong beer brand in Guinness as well.
I mean, this Hop House Lager.
Lager is... going great guns in the sort of British market.
Mm.
But generally speaking, what's going on is that the company's getting smarter with its sales. It's bringing new products, it's bringing new gins, new liqueurs. It's had a new bourbon whiskey in America. And what it's also doing, it's becoming more efficient, taking costs out and reinvesting that into sales to try and drive sales. There's still a bit of work to do here. If you look at the major spirits companies, Diageo, in terms of sales growth, actually is a laggard. But its trend in underlying organic sales growth is on the up. Its margins are on the up. Its cash generation is frankly superb.
And the price? That's the big question.
The price... is when I wrote the article, I've not looked at the price for the last day or so. You could pick these up for about just under 22 times next 12 months' earnings.
Doesn't feel overly expensive.
Well, it isn't, and it's certainly a lot cheaper than the likes of Brown-Forman and Remy Cointreau are selling for. And this is a business that is phenomenally difficult to copy. No one could start from scratch and put together assets and brands like this. And they're doing a good job. There's still momentum in this company from what I can see. And I think all this is feeding through to much better financial performance in terms of margins, cash generation, and growth.
Mm.
So I think These are seen as very dependable earning streams. We have a supporting demographic in terms of wealthier populations in emerging markets who want to trade up to these products, and I think Diageo is pretty well placed to do well from that.
Excellent. No, it's a good piece of analysis. A lot of analysis. And I'm sure we'll be seeing more quality stocks identified in the weeks ahead. Anyway, thank you, Phil, and thank you, Harriet. Lots more in the magazine this week. I've already run through a couple of the features. Gold, we're looking at AIM, gold miners in particular, and seeing if there's any value there, which we think there is. Lots in the personal finance and fund section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. Lots of comments. Really interesting piece actually around BT and its management changes from Paul Jackson in our No Free Lunch column. Fair bit of news this week. A big Aston Martin piece there, which we've talked about before on the podcast. A look at some of the outsourcing companies and some of the problems that they continue to face, and lots of results as well. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you again, Harriet and Phil. We'll be back again next week. But in the meantime, get to the newsagent and pick up the magazine, AIM's Golden Nuggets, sifting for the best value gold miners, £4.90. Or get on the website and take advantage of that Black Friday subscription offer. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.